As April turned to May, Joe Biden was still trying to find Republican support for his agenda. Despite their early disappointments with the GOP, Biden and his staff were still meeting on infrastructure with a group of old guard Senate Republicans, seasoned legislators like Roy Blunt, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, and Roger Wicker of Mississippi. In one meeting, Biden showed how determined he was to strike a deal during an unusually tense exchange with his vice president. On May 13th, the president hosted six Republicans in the Oval Office with Kamala Harris at his side. The group had not yet given Biden an acceptable counteroffer on infrastructure, and Biden was pressing them to support $1 trillion in new infrastructure spending. The group was resisting and pleading with Biden not to undo the corporate tax cuts they passed in 2017. Harris thought there was something missing from the conversation, and she spoke up to say so. What about the rest of the investments the administration wanted in infrastructure? In April alone, the White House had laid out proposals to spend more than $4 trillion on a combination of hard infrastructure and what it called human infrastructure, the social benefits and family support programs so dear to Democrats. Harris wanted the latter category of spending to be part of the conversation, and she began to make the case for a larger package than the one Republicans seemed to have in mind. Biden dismissed her comment immediately. "That's all fine, but these guys aren't going for that," the president said, according to two people present for the exchange. It was such a terse response that even the Republican senators were taken aback. Biden wasn't wrong. They would never vote for the American Family Plan. But none of them had previously seen him shut down his vice president like that. Biden was usually scrupulously respectful of his running mate. The two enjoyed a friendly, if not close, relationship, and Biden had been serious about keeping his campaign trail promise to make Harris the last person in the room on major decisions. In April, Harris had told CNN that she had been the last person Biden consulted before finalizing his decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. But beneath the two running mates' rapport, there was a deepening tension in the administration about Harris's political role and her place in Biden's insular operation. Biden had chosen her as his running mate for tactical reasons, to help him win an election and bridge the gap to a new and more diverse cohort of voters. But Biden had also held up Harris to the country as a picture of the political future and vowed that she would be one of the most influential people in his White House. That promise represented another test for the president and his administration. But Biden showed the country that there was a genuinely powerful place for the history-making figure at his side. Or would Harris be relegated to a limited and largely symbolic role? The question had been on Harris's mind from the start, even before the 2020 campaign was over. In a conversation before the election with Mary Kay Henry, the president of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, and one of the most important women in the labor movement, Harris said she was determined to be known for more than just breaking identity-based barriers. She was proud to be the first woman of color nominated for vice president by a major party, but with Henry, a path-breaking figure in her own right, Harris was thinking beyond that. Harris said she wanted to get big things done, Henry recalls. She doesn't want the history-making aspect of her occupying certain seats to eclipse the job she does, Henry says. During the campaign, Harris had resisted the apparent efforts of Biden's senior staff to contain her and stage manage her. The Biden campaign had named a team of aides to manage Harris even before announcing her as the pick, in part to keep the vice presidential candidate on a tight political leash. But Harris was not accustomed to letting other people choose her staff for her. She had not gotten along with Karine Jean-Pierre, the 43-year-old aide designated by Biden's team as her chief of staff on the campaign, and almost immediately sidelined her. After Election Day, Jean-Pierre went to work in the West Wing as Biden's deputy press secretary. Like many politicians, Harris would often pass along advice she got from her own outside advisors and donors, on matters from strategy to personnel to the Biden team, a habit that grated on Biden's close-knit crew. She lobbied the Biden team to bring in more black senior advisors, urging them to hire the high-profile pollster Cornell Belcher and Karen Finney, a communication strategist with extensive experience on presidential races. Campaign officials passed on both suggestions, with some privately expressing annoyance that Harris seemed to be overlooking the sizable number of African-American staffers on the campaign who were not as well known as Belcher and Finney. After the election, Harris was determined to recruit a formidable chief aide to run her operation. She told one political ally during the transition, "I want my own Ron Klain." She had found a forceful deputy in Tina Flournoy, a former top aide to Bill Clinton. 8 years Harris's senior, Flournoy was part of a tightly bonded network of black women of her generation who had become an influential presence in Washington. As Harris's chief of staff, Flournoy would become something of a bridge between a set of important outside advisors to Harris, women like Donna Brazile, the former Democratic Party chair, and the veteran Democratic operative Minion Moore, and Biden's predominantly white advisors who knew Flournoy better than they knew the vice president. Yet as Biden and Harris were taking office, there was still no policy portfolio for her vice presidency, and it was not clear that Harris had one in mind for herself. In early December, the two running mates sat for a joint interview with the CNN anchor Jake Tapper. When Tapper asked Harris whether she would have ownership of any particular issues, the way Biden did with the 2009 stimulus, the president-elect interjected. His running mate, Biden said vaguely, would deal with whatever the urgent need is at the moment. Harris did not elaborate on her boss's foggy comment. In the absence of a substantive assignment, Harris appeared to some Biden aides to fixate on perceived slights, and Flournoy found herself running damage control errands that had little to do with important functions of state. The first flashpoint of 2021 came the weekend after the mob attack on the Capitol, when an upcoming Vogue cover featuring Harris leaked on social media. The picture the publication had selected from a photo shoot with Harris showed her standing before a pink and green backdrop, clasping her hands and looking at the camera with a somewhat uncertain expression. It was an approachable but less than grand depiction of the incoming vice president. Harris was wounded. She felt belittled by the magazine, asking aides, "Would Vogue depict another world leader this way?" 4 days after the January 6th riot, Harris's spokespeople were deployed to brief reporters about what they were treating as an act of perfidy by Anna Wintour, Vogue's editor-in-chief. They had been expecting another photo, featuring a gold and regal-looking background, and showing Harris in a confident arms-crossed pose. The story of the backlash made the jump from Twitter to the Today Show. Simone Sanders, the strategist, still new to Harris's team, reached Wintour by phone to communicate the displeasure of the vice president-elect. The magazine editor protested that she had personally selected that image for the cover because she believed it made Harris appear relatable. Flournoy was caught off guard by the anger in Harris's circle and reached out to a senior Biden campaign official to ask what she should do. The inauguration was less than 2 weeks away. Washington looked like a military encampment, and the House was racing toward impeaching Donald Trump. The Biden advisor told Flournoy that this was not the time to be going to war with Vogue over a comparatively trivial aesthetic issue. "Tina," the advisor said, "these are first-world problems." The exchange was the start of recurring tensions between the vice president and the West Wing. The Harris team's initial attempt to claim a policy portfolio for her ran into skepticism in the White House, further stoking hard feelings between the vice president and some of Biden's closest aides. Hoping to carve out an international portfolio for Harris, her staff floated the possibility of the vice president overseeing relations with the Nordic countries, a low-risk diplomatic assignment that might have helped Harris get adjusted to the international stage in welcoming venues like Oslo and Copenhagen. White House aides rejected the idea and privately mocked it. More irritating to Biden aides was when they learned the vice president wanted to plan a major speech to outline her view of foreign policy. Biden aides vetoed the idea. Why should a vice president have their own independently articulated view of global affairs? Harris played only a minor part in the development of the American Rescue Plan. Though she'd served in the Senate with Manchin, unlike Biden, Harris had little relationship with him, and after her foray into West Virginia television, she played no role in trying to secure his decisive vote. She had built few close relationships in Congress. Like Barack Obama before her, she was often running for president just 2 years after entering the body. Harris had not designed her Senate career the way other lawmakers did, carefully building friendships with an eye toward eventually becoming a committee chair or caucus leader. Even to the new generation of progressive lawmakers, Harris was someone they mostly knew from afar. Jamal Bowman, the New York progressive, had only seen the vice president on television when he arrived in Washington. Then he spent time with Harris at the White House and at a Congressional Black Caucus reception she held poolside at her residence. "When you see her in person, she's incredibly impressive," says Bowman, lamenting that her engaging persona did not come through on camera. At the White House, though, visitors from the Hill saw scant evidence that the vice president was actually shaping the administration's thinking. Her contact with lawmakers was mostly a matter of formalities. A thank you call, for example, to Jim McGovern, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, for moving the legislation so speedily. Other calls, including with her former Senate colleagues, were heavy on small talk, with Harris asking about family but speaking little about policy or political strategy. Larry Hogan, the Republican governor of Maryland, came away perplexed after a meeting with Biden and Harris about the relief package. Biden had been typically expressive in the meeting, buttering up Hogan and several other governors with talk of wanting to work together. The vice president's role, Hogan says, was very strange. Harris did not say a word, he recalls, speculating that perhaps Harris was just being deferential to the president, didn't want to step on him. Harris was still figuring out what Biden wanted from her and what she could do to develop real influence in his administration. In some ways, her challenges were distinctive and highly sensitive. Harris was the first woman and the first black person to serve as vice president, and she was looking for a place of influence in a White House led by an elderly white man whose closest advisors were mainly white, male, and far closer to the president on a personal level than she was. But the vice presidency was also a fundamentally inchoate job, one that had little actual power or relevance to day-to-day governing. For most of American history, it had been a largely ceremonial and often mocked job. The string of more influential vice presidents around the turn of the century, Al Gore, Dick Cheney, and Biden himself, had been a departure from the historical norm. Harris was up against structural problems that went beyond personality conflicts with the West Wing. She reached out to Gore for advice and spoke with Walter Mondale before his death in April, seeking counsel from the Minnesotan who, as Jimmy Carter's running mate, made the first great attempt to redefine the vice presidency as a governing role. She spoke, too, with former presidents, Obama, of course, but also with Bill Clinton. And she began testing what she could do to shape the administration's agenda. If Harris had played a muted role on the rescue plan, she was more vocal internally on another subject, black maternal health. As a senator, she had joined a group of lawmakers pushing for federal funding to address the alarmingly high rate of maternal death among black women. Harris had lobbied other Democratic senators to sign on to a package of maternal health legislation and made it an issue in her presidential primary campaign before Biden took up some of the same policy promises in the general election. Lauren Underwood, the Illinois Democrat who worked with Harris on the so-called momnibus measures in Congress, says it was clear from the start that the Biden administration was serious about helping vulnerable black mothers. Underwood says she knew who to credit for that. "I think that is 100% a function of Kamala Harris being the vice president," Underwood says, adding of Harris, "I think she's exceptional." While Harris was determined not to be defined chiefly by her history-making identity, her race and gender had made her an especially meaningful leader for millions of Democratic voters. That was vividly apparent in the middle of March, after the massacre in Atlanta, when Biden and Harris flew down to meet with Asian American leaders. For a community that had faced a surge in hate crimes during the pandemic, it was a crucial sign of concern from the White House. Biden began the meeting by telling the group that he was there to listen to their needs. Neither he nor the vice president said anything especially distinctive, but Harris's presence meant something important to the distressed people she was visiting. When she told them that it was up to them to be champions for the community, the word sounded different than they might have coming from a previous vice president like Mike Pence or Joe Biden. It was Bi Nguyen, a state representative of Vietnamese descent, who said as much to Harris. It was comforting, she told the vice president, that Harris herself was an Asian American woman who grew up in an immigrant family. Looking back on the event, Nguyen recalls feeling that it was important that the vice president, would understand the intersections of misogyny and sexism and xenophobia at work in the attack. When Biden finally gave Harris a new assignment at the end of March, it was not one she welcomed. Amid a surge in unlawful crossings at the country's southern border, Biden tasked her with outreach to the three Central American countries where a huge share of migrants originated: Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Harris had no deep grounding in Latin America policy, but the so-called Northern Triangle had been one of Biden's assignments as Obama's vice president, and now he was passing it on to her. It was a politically undesirable task, and Harris's staff knew it. Republicans had been battering the administration over the border situation, and even some Texas Democrats were openly critical of the president's team. Harris was resigned to the assignment, but she and her team wanted to make sure her role was depicted in the narrowest possible way. She would take on the Northern Triangle, traveling to Central America and negotiating with governments there, but under no circumstances did she want to be branded Biden's border czar. Harris did not hesitate to chide Biden for characterizing her assignment in those terms. When the two of them met in mid-April with leaders of the Congressional Black Caucus, Biden poured out praise for Harris, crediting her in particular for her passionate advocacy for black maternal health. But the president also made the mistake of saying that he had given Harris the important assignment of handling immigration. Harris, he said, was going to do a hell of a job. The vice president corrected him at once. "Excuse me," she said, "it's the Northern Triangle, not immigration." Harris's concern about being depicted as Biden's border cop proved well-founded. She came under immediate pressure to visit the border and struggled with media questions about when she would do so. On a trip to Guatemala, the NBC anchor Lester Holt interviewed Harris and pointed out that she had not yet visited the border. "And I haven't been to Europe," Harris replied with a strained laugh. The exchange dominated American coverage of her visit to Central America. To Biden's staff, it was a strange and disappointing turn for the vice president. Holt's question had been entirely foreseeable, and yet Harris had seemed totally thrown. Had her staff failed to prepare her? Or was the vice president just a very uneven performer? The political fallout came in another form, too. Harris had carried a tough message on her trip to Central America, and at a press conference in Guatemala, she addressed herself directly to potential migrants with a three-word message: "Do not come." Harris had also acknowledged that many migrants were fleeing brutal violence and extreme poverty, but some leaders of the left had bristled at what they saw as a harsh admonition. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez voiced her dismay, calling Harris's comments disappointing and arguing that migrants were legitimately fleeing instability inflicted on them in part by the United States. It was a bruising hit from a wing of the party that Harris had courted on and off for years, and it enraged White House aides who saw it as a cheap shot at the whole administration by way of a convenient target. Cedric Richmond found it despicable, and in an interview, the former chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus questioned Ocasio-Cortez's motives. "AOC's hit on Kamala was despicable," Richmond says. "I don't know if it's ambition. I don't know if it's intention. I don't know if it's clickbait. But what it did for me is show a clear misunderstanding of what's going on in the world." After all, Richmond says, Harris only said what Biden had already said. Harris was unsettled after the Central America trip, and Klain knew it. The chief of staff approached her after she returned to Washington and reminded her she was hardly the first vice president to endure tough coverage. "It was the nature of the job," he said, "and it had not stopped several of her predecessors, like George H.W. Bush and, yes, Joe Biden, from ultimately attaining the presidency." Klain was not entirely soothing, however. He also shared with Harris a candid view of political reality. "Not every Democrat loved Joe Biden," he said, "but people across the party saw their own success as closely intertwined with the success of the president." Democrats, Klain explained, did not feel that way about the vice president. Within weeks of Harris's trip, stories began popping up about dysfunction in the vice president's office. Politico reported that several aides had already quietly quit the Harris team and that some on the inside were blaming Flournoy for the internal friction. Some stories faulted Flournoy for hiccups in the operation, But the truth was that Biden's team regarded Harris's chief of staff as an indispensable steadying influence. Kate Bedingfield, Biden's communications director, had grown weary of fielding questions about Harris's team and whether the White House was mismanaging her role in the vice presidency. In private, Bedingfield had taken to noting that the vice presidency was not the first time in Harris's political career that she had fallen short of sky-high expectations. Her Senate office had been messy, and her presidential campaign had been a fiasco. Perhaps, she suggested, the problem was not the vice president's staff. Bedingfield was not the only Biden advisor whose patience was tested. West Wing aides had been annoyed for months about having to tend to Harris and what they saw as gaps in her operation, some of which generated bitter gripes from congressional Democrats. When Klain met in April with the new Democrats, one lawmaker, Kathy Manning, had complained about being left out of parts of Harris's recent visit to her North Carolina district. He had not concealed his displeasure. "That makes me want to vomit," he said, according to one person's account of the meeting. Remarkably, comments like that had stayed private at the time. It was only after Harris's trip to Central America that a trickle of leaks began to accelerate. No one was more frustrated by the leaks than Joe Biden. The president had known many of Harris's shortcomings when he chose her to be his running mate, but he was defensive of her and irritated by the unsightly drama spilling into view. Calling his senior staff into the Oval Office, Biden gave them a warning. If he found that any of them was stirring up negative stories about the vice president, Biden said, they would quickly be former staff. By early June, Biden had given Harris another assignment that was no less difficult than the Northern Triangle, but more central to the Democratic Party's agenda, voting rights. Harris had asked Biden to give her a piece of that critical issue, and the president had agreed. The vice president's office began convening meetings with civil rights leaders and state-level Democrats who were battling a wave of Republican legislation tightening voting laws in order to placate millions of Trump voters firmly and wrongly convinced that there had been election tampering in 2020. House Democrats had passed a sprawling election reform bill, known as For the People Act, or H.R. 1. That overhauled everything from voter registration and early voting laws to campaign finance regulation and the redrawing of congressional districts. But it had stalled in the Senate, where it did not even have support from all 50 Democrats. Democratic congressional leaders had treated the bill as a kind of holy grail, a legislative prize among prizes that would keep elections safe for a generation. In an interview after her chamber passed H.R. 1, Nancy Pelosi said the Democracy Reform Bill was so important that the Senate should modify its voting rules to get it done, either by abolishing the filibuster or carving out an exception for voting rights bills. If the measure did not pass, then Pelosi said she believed American democracy was all but doomed and lawmakers might as well go to the beach and forget the whole thing. Some party officials acknowledged privately that H.R. 1 had originally been crafted as a so-called message bill, legislation aimed at fomenting a desirable debate on policy, casting Democrats as champions of clean government, and forcing Republicans to vote against popular reform policies. It was not a piece of legislation that ever had a chance of clearing a 50-50 Senate as long as the filibuster was in place, but Democrats believed some new voting legislation was of vital importance, and they hoped some essential components of the bill, such as a ban on congressional gerrymandering and protections for mail-in voting, could pass in some form. Pelosi was hardly the only leader in her party who believed the integrity of democracy itself was at stake. As the year went on, she grew frustrated that the White House was not doing more to lobby for action on the For the People Act. In an Oval Office meeting, the Speaker trashed Biden's advisor, Anita Dunn, who was not present in the session, for questioning just how urgent the legislation really was. When Klain spoke up to defend his colleague, Pelosi questioned his commitment to the bill, too. If Pelosi was incensed, Biden's advisors were equally annoyed at her attachment to the catch-all bill, especially some of the proposed campaign finance restrictions that they feared would actually hinder Democrats more than Republicans. Biden himself was somewhat ambivalent about the measure. The president's main concern was not gerrymandering or campaign finance reform, but election subversion by foreign enemies or homegrown saboteurs. Pelosi's cherished bill did nothing to address that threat. Yet, by the late spring, there had been no further movement on the bill or on any of the other Democratic priorities that could not necessarily be enacted through the budget reconciliation process. The obstacles in the Senate were the same as ever. Republicans were not interested in helping Democrats overcome the filibuster, and Democrats did not have the votes to abolish the filibuster and make the Senate a majority rule institution. At the end of April, Chuck Schumer found himself confronted by a group of donors who wanted to know what the problem was. If Democrats really believed the bill could save democracy, why was it frozen in the Senate? Schumer pleaded for time. He had two main goals at the moment, he said, and they were advancing infrastructure legislation and passing the For the People Act. Schumer did not quite say so, but the hope that had taken hold among Democratic leaders in Congress and the White House was that by doing the first of those, they would unlock a path to doing the second. Perhaps if Manchin and Sinema and the other Senate centrists felt that they had stood up for bipartisanship with an infrastructure deal, they could be persuaded to push through other legislation on a party-line basis and maybe even to abolish or weaken the filibuster. But an infrastructure deal remained elusive, and Democratic frustration was mounting. Progressives in the House were starting to lash out, and with some justification. They had been promised a transformational agenda if they got on board with Biden, not a pandemic relief bill and a bunch of excuses about Senate procedure. In the middle of May, there had been friction between Pelosi and Mondaer Jones, the young New York progressive, in a meeting of the House Democratic leadership. When the subject of the Capitol Police came up, Jones voiced sharp skepticism of the force. Repeating a story he also told publicly, Jones said his chief of staff had noticed a copy of an anti-Semitic tract, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, lying around at a security checkpoint on Capitol Hill. Jones remained convinced that some of the cops were a potential security threat. In a moment of tension, the 81-year-old Speaker of the House carefully pushed back on the young freshman from Westchester. "The Capitol Police saved their lives," Pelosi responded. It was obvious she did not want to discuss the subject further with her leadership team. But the issue was not over. Jones was hardly the only lawmaker who worried about the integrity of the Capitol Police, and black Democrats in particular had long expressed concern about racial bias within the force. Jim Clyburn, the 81-year-old Democratic whip, had been outspoken on the subject for years. In the fall of 2021, a member of the Capitol Force would be indicted on charges of obstructing justice for allegedly advising one of the January 6 rioters over social media to delete evidence of their activities that day. Yet Clyburn and other older black Democrats recoiled from the confrontational tactics of a younger, more left-wing generation. Indeed, Clyburn's open criticism of defund the police activists had so rankled a pair of newly elected progressives, Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush, that a fourth black lawmaker, the 74-year-old progressive Barbara Lee, had to step in to mediate a truce between Clyburn and Bush early in 2021. The activist left had not given up the cause, however. On May 20th, a handful of hardline progressives decided to make a stand by declining to vote for legislation that included $1.9 billion in funding for the Capitol Police, leaving the measure teetering until it finally passed by a single vote. It was a clear warning shot to Democratic leaders, and one the centrist wing of the party took as a grim omen of left-wing brinksmanship to come. While the measure was in limbo, Ron Kind of Wisconsin, a moderate Democrat from a pro-Trump district, approached one of his centrist colleagues on the floor and asked a demoralized question. "Why are we here?" There was also growing Democratic frustration with the White House for less ideological reasons. Biden and his advisors had talked a big game about promoting their economic relief and vaccination programs, predicting that a shots and checks mantra could help Democrats stave off the defeat a president's party usually suffers in off-year elections. But with Biden's larger agenda slowing down and the president personally enmeshed in negotiations with Republicans, neither he nor Harris had spent nearly as much time as Democrats had hoped barnstorming the country to promote their achievements. The president's aides had shielded him from the press to the best of their ability, even though Biden himself often seemed eager to engage the reporters who shouted questions at him. He did not hold a formal press conference until March 25th and did not conduct a second one until the end of his first overseas trip in June. By spring, he had given just two extended television interviews to CBS's Nora O'Donnell and George Stephanopoulos of ABC News. Both demonstrated that Biden's staff had good reason to fear his interactions with the press. The president had never been known for his verbal discipline, but age seemed to loosen his tongue further, and his staff had to clarify his answers from each sit-down. With Stephanopoulos, Biden had spoken too freely for comfort on several sensitive topics, calling Vladimir Putin of Russia a killer and speculating that his friend, Andrew Cuomo, the scandal-plagued governor of New York, could face prosecution for sexual misconduct. As a result of moments like those, the former Obama advisor David Axelrod liked to joke that Biden's aides suffered from performance anxiety. The president performed, and they got anxious. The administration deployed other high-profile officials to go on television or tour the battleground states, from the First Lady and the Vice President to the Transportation Secretary, Peter Buttigieg. But in the middle of May, one swing state lawmaker, Stephanie Murphy of Florida, raised concerns about the White House message with the vice president face-to-face. During a meeting in Harris's office with a group of Asian-American Democrats, Murphy told Harris she was dismayed to see how her home state governor, Ron DeSantis, was holding events that showcased initiatives he could only afford because of money in the American Rescue Plan. The administration had pivoted away from the rescue plan too quickly, Murphy said. DeSantis should not be able to claim an ounce of credit for legislation the GOP opposed. While none of them would say so publicly, some of Biden's political advisors had also begun to worry that Democrats were not doing enough to press their advantage on issues related to the pandemic and the economic recovery. Coronavirus cases were still falling, and while there were some worrisome signs of inflation, the overall trajectory of the economy was positive. But on many days, Biden was talking about issues that had fizzled in the Senate or about infrastructure, an important subject with a dry and generic name. Concerned that Biden was sacrificing a valuable political opportunity, John Anzalone, the president's chief pollster, urged the White House in May to stop talking about infrastructure negotiations and start calling whatever it was they were talking about the jobs bill. In a memo addressed directly to Biden at the beginning of June, Anzalone warned that Democratic economic policies were not selling themselves. In focus groups, voters in swing states were starting to bring up inflation as a concern, as well as the enhanced unemployment benefits that some businesses had begun to blame for their difficulties in hiring. The country was starting to worry about crime, too, Anzalone wrote. Republican leaders are likely to attempt to ratchet up attacks and tie national Democrats to the trend. Anzalone also noted a striking result from recent polling. Biden was the only national leader voters saw as genuinely interested in reaching across the aisle. That set him apart from his own party's congressional leaders, Schumer and Pelosi, as well as their opposite numbers in the GOP, McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. But Anzalone said Biden's image as a conciliator was not an unalloyed asset. Voters of both parties largely share the view that bipartisan efforts result in the best policy, he wrote. Still, there are indications that some Democrats are not willing to forego action in favor of bipartisanship. Starting in June, though, Biden would get a succession of encouraging election results in off-year primaries. To a White House concerned about divisions in the Democratic Party, it came as great relief to see Terry McAuliffe, a gregarious centrist in the Joe Biden mold, win a primary election for governor of Virginia. In New York City, too, Democratic voters had chosen a moderate black ex-cop, Eric Adams, as their nominee for mayor. In both elections, voters had spurned candidates who ran far to the left, including those who had campaigned on shifting money away from the police. Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, was a charismatic but flawed politician who was facing serious questions about his financial ethics and his general credibility, and had mounted vicious attacks on other Democrats in the race. But Biden took his victory as a sign that his party was still with him. During a July meeting with Adams and several other city officials from around the country, Biden pulled aside the New Yorker to tell him how badly the Democratic Party needed leaders like him. Adams, he said, was a perfect match for the moment, a figure who could talk with clear authority both about reforming the police and fighting crime. That combination, Biden said, was something we've never had in this country. We still need your help in the midterm elections, the president told Adams. The New Yorker was delighted to promise his assistance. I'm going to work my ass off, he told Biden. Less than half a year into his term, Biden could already feel the next campaign coming. The midterm elections were still more than a year away, but the voting rules and congressional maps that would govern those elections would be set in a matter of months, and Democrats had still not made much progress toward a national election reform law. Joe Biden flashed sudden impatience on the subject during a trip to Oklahoma on June 1st. The president was visiting Tulsa to commemorate the centennial anniversary of the 1921 massacre carried out by a white mob against the thriving black neighborhood of Greenwood. It was the first time a sitting president had commemorated one of the ugliest episodes in modern American history. That event, Biden said in Tulsa, can't be buried in the country's memory. In the speech, Biden addressed an onslaught of voting restrictions making their way through red state legislatures. It was a truly unprecedented assault on our democracy, Biden said, with the franchise of black Americans at stake. Veering from the prepared text, the president acknowledged that he frequently heard people on television asking why he couldn't get a voting rights law done. The reason, Biden said, was that he only has a majority of effectively 4 votes in the House and a tie in the Senate. And, Biden added, there were 2 members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends. It was obvious he meant Manchin and Sinema. The president realized almost immediately that he had made a mistake. While Manchin and Sinema were the least cooperative Senate Democrats, it was not true that they mostly voted with Republicans. Antagonizing them would do nothing to help Biden advance his agenda. Biden knew he would have to reach out to the senators to smooth things over. He told a senior aide, I shouldn't have said that. Cedric Richmond recalls that the White House hoped Manchin and Sinema would take Biden's remarks in the spirit he'd intended, as a criticism of his skeptics in the press. Richmond says Biden and his team understood that Manchin, at least, was the best governing partner Democrats could expect from a state as red as West Virginia. The alternative, Richmond says, is a Republican, and your agenda flat-ass stalls. It is dead in its tracks. Yet there had already been months of hand-holding and smoothing over with Manchin and Sinema, and Biden did not have much to show for it. Flat-ass stalled was an apt prognosis for voting rights and a whole lot else. Democrats close to Manchin still believed he was open to taking party-line action on voting rights, but he had not abandoned his support for the filibuster. He was in talks with Republicans on what he hoped would become a viable voting rights compromise. But those efforts seemed doomed to nearly everyone but him. The amiable West Virginian, always eager to burnish his image as a reasonable dealmaker, conferred with civil rights leaders in early June, telling them that he wanted to get something done, but he wanted any voting bill to be bipartisan, pointing out that many Republicans would not even meet with civil rights groups. Marc Morial, the head of the National Urban League, asked if Manchin could connect them with his GOP allies. A follow-up conversation with Republicans turned into a fiasco. 2 of the civil rights leaders recall that Susan Collins asked them why she should support a federal election reform law when the voting process in Maine worked well for her. Her statement just indicated what I had always believed, that this is not about our Constitution. This is about their political survival, says Derek Johnson, the head of the NAACP. There was seemingly no bipartisan way forward on voting rights, and without a major shift on the filibuster from Manchin and several other Democrats, there was no backup path either. Johnson says that by this point, his group had identified as many as 7 Democratic senators who held Manchin-like positions on the filibuster, even if they were not willing to say so publicly. If that math was right, it represented a terrible obstacle to most of Biden's remaining agenda. When Johnson and his allies met with Biden on July 8th, they came away uncertain of whether the president even had a theory of how to advance voting rights in Congress. Several civil rights leaders came prepared with tactical suggestions. Charlene Ifill, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, proposed attaching voting rights regulations to federal funding for elections. Perhaps, she suggested, that could make it possible to include them in a reconciliation-style bill that could pass with just 50 votes. Al Sharpton pushed Biden on the filibuster, telling the president that if the procedural roadblock remained in place, then Democrats would suffer in the midterms. Biden took notes laboriously, but he and his aides were noncommittal. He agreed with Sharpton that there should be some kind of change to the filibuster, but did not say what that change should look like. In any event, Biden said he did not want to make the filibuster the center of political debate. Though Biden did not say as much himself, the Republicans with whom Biden was negotiating on infrastructure would certainly have been outraged by a sudden White House push to change the Senate rules. So, what did that leave the civil rights groups with as they departed the White House? Like so many other White House visitors in 2021, they collected praise from the president about the importance of their electoral constituency. Biden again hailed the role of black voters in his campaign, telling Melanie Campbell, the head of the National Coalition of Black Civic Participation, that black women were the reason he occupied the Oval Office. It was a flattering and sincere sentiment, but flattery would not protect the franchise. And just 2 weeks later, at another CNN-hosted town hall meeting, Biden again blurted out something his own base did not want to hear. He admitted he was deeply uneasy about the idea of ending the filibuster. Doing so, he told the network's Don Lemon in Cincinnati, could throw the entire Congress into chaos and nothing will get done. It would only be later, deeper into the summer, that Biden would reveal to a different set of White House visitors his apparent strategy on voting rights. Hosting an array of Asian American advocacy groups on August 5th, the president found himself again challenged on the subject of election integrity. One participant nudged Biden to consider the significance of Asian American voters to his own campaign. No group had improved its turnout numbers more, making a decisive difference in crucial states like Georgia, where state-level Republicans had tightened the voting rules for 2022. The president at first responded with the usual bromides about the electoral importance of his guests. At the mention of sky-high Asian American turnout, Biden cut in, "Don't you think I noticed that?" But on the larger issue of his stalled agenda and the fate of voting rights, the president finally said out loud what he and other Democrats had been saying privately for months. "If I had done voting rights first, I would not have been able to get 50 votes for it in the Senate," Biden said. "There would have been several Democrats out of reach. But if we get infrastructure done," Biden said, "then we will have the votes we need." That forecast seemed as much a hope as it was a strategy. There was no hard guarantee, even in the dead of summer, that passing a bipartisan infrastructure bill would persuade Manchin, Sinema, or anyone else to support new legislation or new Senate rules that they did not already support. But for Biden and his closest allies on Capitol Hill, it was the best shot left to get anything big done. The president was making an enormous bet that one major bipartisan deal on infrastructure would bring his party into line on a larger agenda that would transform the American social safety net, attack the climate crisis, and reform the rules of democracy. As the summer wore on, that wager would prove to be an extraordinarily risky one. The summer also brought a rare opportunity for Kamala Harris to interact with a woman who had walked the tightrope of world leadership longer and arguably better than just about any other person of her gender, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, then nearing the end of her fourth term in office. While Harris had made her own errors as a presidential candidate and as vice president, there was no question that she had faced sexism and racism throughout her career in national politics. Amid the legitimate critiques of Harris, there had always been cruel mockery and demonization of a kind male politicians seldom faced, most recently from snickering Fox News and talk radio personalities who ridiculed her in grotesque language. Perhaps just as grating to Harris, though, was the criticism that she knew circulated inside the building, from a White House full of people who had taken a negative view of Harris's political instincts and abilities since the Democratic primaries. Some of Harris's advisors believed the president's almost entirely white inner circle did not show the vice president the respect she deserved. Harris worried that Biden's staff looked down on her. She fixated on real and perceived snubs in a way the West Wing found tedious. At one point, she dispatched Flournoy, her top aide, to speak with Anita Dunn about a subject of concern to the vice president. When Harris walked into a room, the White House staff did not stand up the way they did for Biden, Flournoy told Dunn. The vice president took it as a sign of disrespect. When Merkel came to Washington for a state dinner in July, Harris wanted to connect with the most powerful woman on the planet, a role that Harris herself might occupy soon enough. At a White House meeting on infrastructure just before Merkel's visit, Harris sought out Phil Murphy, the New Jersey governor and former ambassador to Germany, for advice about interacting with the chancellor. Murphy enjoyed a warm relationship with Merkel and her husband, and he told Harris that the German stateswoman and her country were desperate to believe that the Trump years had been an ugly but temporary experience for the United States. Anything you can do to convince her that you and Biden represent the real America might go a long way, Murphy said. Over breakfast at the Naval Observatory on July 15th, Merkel raised that subject with Harris right away. The chancellor asked, "How can Europe be confident that Trump was an aberration?" Harris's answer was measured and vivid. Gesturing to her own arms, the vice president said, "Sometimes people have an illness just beneath the skin. They can keep it under control with the right medicine, but sometimes it breaks out and appears on the surface." Trump, she said, represented a bubbling up of a contagion that had been in the American system for a long time. And Harris acknowledged that the underlying illness was likely not gone just because Trump had lost the election. But lost he had, Harris reminded Merkel. Voters had turned out in immense numbers to reject him. America was ready for a change. It was a delicate and partial version of reassurance that Harris offered, and an honest one. And Harris soon found that the German leader also had a mixed message of reassurance for her. Merkel told the vice president she understood Harris's unique place as a woman in American politics and many of the burdens it carried, and spoke in some detail about the obstacles she had faced in her own rise. If Harris needed advice in the future, Merkel told her, she would be glad to be in touch.